We are in Psalm 12. We're going to do this one in 13 and 14. They are pretty short, though. It's not a whole lot here. But let's start with Psalm 12. And this is what Charles Spurgeon called good thoughts in bad times. Anyway, let's go ahead and get into it. So somebody read verse 1.
Help, Lord, for the godly man ceases, for the faithful disappear from among the sons of men.
All right, so David was kind of experiencing the same thing we're experiencing today. The faithful are becoming fewer every year. We do not make new converts fast enough to offset the older generation dying.
Believe it or not.
Christianity is getting smaller all the time. People are dying. Satan has his hooks in this younger generation, and he is not letting them go easy, I will tell you. He's hanging on to them pretty tight. By doing that, there's a momentum that goes with that. Anything you're doing, the more people you get to do it, the more people want to do it. That's just how it works. Advertising is called the bandwagon effect. You have to get on the bandwagon with all your friends and neighbors because they're all doing it. You should do it too. That's what we're seeing today. And David's prayer is the one we all need to pray. Very short prayer right there at the beginning.
Help, Lord.
Help. We should call for the Lord's help anytime we are going through anything. There's nothing we will ever face that is bigger than the Lord. And we should learn just to call on Him for help when we see things going south. When we do that, we need to learn to turn things over to Him, though. If you want God to take care of the battle, you need to give Him the battle. If you want to fight it yourself, don't drag Him into it because He'll either take it all or He'll take nothing of it. So it's up to you. If you want peace in your life, you've got to turn things over to God. All right, 2 through 4.
They speak vanity, every one with his neighbor. With flattering lips and with a double heart do they speak. The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips and the tongue that speaketh proud things. Who hath said, with our tongue will we prevail, our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us?
All right, so David is talking about the empty words coming from double-minded people. Verse 2, David uses vanity in the same context or the same word as Solomon in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2. Anybody want to read that? Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2. Must be a tough book to find.
Ecclesiastes what?
1, verse 2.
Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity.
All right, so what he was talking about in there and what David is talking about, that word vanity translates to worthless or futile. He's saying everything is worthless or everything is pointless. No reason. It's all just vanity. Verses 3 and 4 refers to those who brag about their righteousness falsely. Or they wrongly believe that they can simply talk their way into heaven. They say the right thing, but their words are hollow and without true meaning. Warren Wiersbe wrote that flattery is not communication, it is manipulation. So be wary of those who flatter you because they only want to control you. That's the purpose of flattery, is to gain control. So that is that one. Let's go with 5 through 8. Look at that, we're going to be a whole chapter in already.
For the oppression of the poor, for the sighing of the needy, now will I arise, saith the Lord. I will set him safely from him that puffeth at him. The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified 7 times. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord. Thou shalt preserve them for this generation forever. The wicked walk on every side when the vilest men are exalted.
All right, so these 4 verses are in stark contrast to the first 4. These four show the difference between the empty words of the sinful and the powerful words of the Lord. God is always aware of our trouble, and he's always there to offer help and support, even when we do not realize it. And that's something we all need to work on. When I ask for praises on Sunday morning, we should be able to take the whole time we're there and just take praises. We should all be recognizing what God is doing for us instead of just assuming life goes on. God's not there. We're just doing our own thing, and God sat back and watched us. That's not how it works. The Lord, one of the things he's talking about, he will keep his words pure, it says up there. He'll keep his Bible intact and whole. You have to remember that. We are talking about the creator of all things, the one who made your eyeballs work. That's a million nerve endings from your eye going to a million nerve endings in your brain, and they meet halfway and they join up perfectly. You got to remember that. The defense used by many people to justify their refusal to believe the Bible is they say it's full of errors or contradictions, or its books are missing, or they should have not put this book in. Whatever reason, they try to attack the validity of the Bible. You cannot attack the validity of the Bible. If God was willing to let his Bible be messed up, he wouldn't be God. That Bible is our instruction book. And if it is not correct, God would make sure it was correct. It's the difference between his submissive will and his divine will. Anything that God wills is going to happen. But he has submissive will. Submissive will works like, I've used the example before, John's going to be the next Billy Graham. That's God's will. I kill John because I operated in God's submissive will. You know what there's going to be? There's still going to be another Billy Graham because God's will is there's another Billy Graham. I just ruined it for John is all I would have done. It doesn't stop God's will from happening. It just stops it for that particular person. When God said, my word is going to be put together, it was put together. It didn't matter who stood in the way or what they tried to do to it. It was put together. And it's part of his divine will that we have this. Think of that. What would our God be worth if he couldn't protect his own word? He wouldn't be worth worship. If you can't even protect your own word, what would be the purpose of worshiping you? Can't be able to do more than that. So you can look at all the stuff that goes on, but you got to remember God is all-powerful and his will always be accomplished. If he can do that with your eyeball, he can definitely do it with a book. There is a humorous saying you might have heard, if God can make a bug's butt light up, think of what he can do for you. Talking about a lightning bug. If he can do that, he can pretty much do whatever he wants to do. David was feeling overwhelmed by the direction the nation was headed. People loved themselves. As we said, the people were few and becoming fewer, and it looked like Satan was winning. It's a pretty good description of our world today, isn't it? David was seeing the same thing, and actually it was a pretty dark time for them at that point. They were being kind of pushed around some. But we need to do, the answer to this whole problem is do what David did, and that's pray those same words, Lord help. For help, Lord. Make sure you get it. Make sure we go to him and ask for help on that. We're going to talk a little bit more about how we change this nation, but that'll be after this study. Let's go on with Psalm 13 and read verses 1 and 2.
How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me?
All right, so David starts this psalm, which is a short one also, by feeling low and maybe even a little depressed. What is the core of each question being asked? What is it?
How long?
How long? How long? David wants to know how long he'll be neglected and forgotten. Yeah. However, we know that God doesn't forget us. There are times when the Lord seems silent, right?
Yeah.
But we have to remember God's timing is perfect. So what should we be doing during those times that God is silent? Yeah. Yep. It should be an opportunity to grow your faith. Keep relying on God. Keep praying to him. Keep talking to him. But he's not ignoring you. Timing. He's just waiting on the right time to fix. Sometimes the struggle you're going through is to strengthen faith. And if you refuse to strengthen your faith, the struggle is going to get even longer because God has a certain place he wants you to be by the time it's over. So make sure you just jump in there and keep your faith strong, keep praying, keep asking. All right, let's go with 3 and 4.
Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Lighten mine eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest mine enemy say, I have prevailed against him. And those that trouble me are rejoice when I am moved.
All right, so there was a change there. What was the change from the first two to these two?
He's now on the positive side of things.
Yeah, he went from questioning to praying. What he did, he went from questioning to praying. It's a model we should follow. You know, it is okay to question God as long as you're truly searching and not accusing. Got to remember that. Do not accuse God, but you can question what he did. You can look at Lazarus' sisters. When Jesus finally showed up, Lazarus had already died, and they both questioned why he tarried so long. Even the disciples wondered why he tarried so long, because their good friend was dying, and he didn't jump up and run to his aid. He didn't show up till he was already dead. He'd already passed. But when they kind of jumped on Jesus for being late, he took it in stride. He didn't tell them they were wrong to question, but he never said a word about that. He actually cried with them, is what he did. So David is asking for strength and deliverance. He needs strength to continue in faith and deliverance. Not so much for himself or his personal interest, but for God's interest. His failure would make God look bad. The nation of Israel failing would have made God look bad. That's what he was worried about. But have you ever really thought about that? Every failure in your life makes God look bad. We really don't have any effect on how God really is, but people's perception of him, we make him look bad in their eyes. We got to be careful of that. And that's what David is not wanting. He's not wanting the perception that God was weak or something like that, or following God was foolish. He wanted people to understand that following God is the victorious path. Losing would have made him look bad. He didn't want that. The truth is, you all have heard it said, the only Bible most people will ever read is the Christian they know. And they're going to judge everything based on their friend's behavior or their acquaintance's behavior. Not only are they watching you, they're hoping or anxiously anticipating your failure, almost always. Because if you can fail, that'll justify their non-belief. That'll show that God is not powerful as you think he is. That'll justify their wrong belief system, whether it's in a different God or whether it's in themselves. It'll justify that. Yes, sir.
Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning.
Right, that's right. Joy comes in the morning. So we got to hang on. Everything changes. Bad times don't last forever, but then again, neither do the good times. Our lives are full of trouble, and we'll be up and down like a roller coaster or a yo-yo. But as long as we wait on God, we'll have that joy. And joy and peace from God is not the absence of trouble. It is peace through that trouble is what it is. You'll be at peace. So, all right, let me see. 5 and 6. We'll finish this chapter 2 while we're at it.
But I have trusted in thy mercy. My heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. I will sing unto the Lord because he hath dealt bountifully with me.
Okay, so he went from despairing to praying, and finally, what's he doing now?
Singing.
What?
Singing.
He
trusted and then he sang.
He sang, right. The biblical word for that or the Christian word for that?
Right.
Close. Starts with a re and ends rejoicing. Very good, Josh. Now, you all of you are right. He's singing, he's praising, but he's rejoicing. It's what he actually even says in here. My heart shall rejoice. That's what he's talking about. You know, trusting God never fails because God never fails. So no matter what you're going through, you should be rejoicing that God's going to see you through that. It'll be over eventually, and God will be there. God's going to give you the strength you need to sustain you through whatever you are going through if you will look to him for that strength. He's not going to give it to you without you asking, and he's not going to give it to you if you're asking for the wrong reasons, but he will be there for you as long as you come to him with a pure heart and pure intentions. All right, now we're going to go to Psalm 14. This chapter is almost verbatim repeated in Psalm 53. There are some slight changes that happen. We'll talk about one of them here shortly, but they are very close. Together with chapters 10 and 12, it's a representation of the ungodly. In 10, it was about their attitude. 12 was about their words. 14 shows us their corrupt actions or deeds or whatever you want to call what they're doing. So let's go with verse 1.
The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. And there is none who does good.
All right. So before we get into explaining this verse, let's go to 1 Samuel 25. I need somebody to read verses 2 and 3, but don't go away because we got one more verse in there to read before we go back to Psalm.
2 and 3?
Yes.
And there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel, and the man was very great, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and a beautiful countenance. But the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb.
All right, so in this story, I'm not going to have you all read that whole thing, but Nabal was a fairly wealthy man, and he was rude to David's men when they went to him for supplies. Even though David's men had protected his shepherds and his flocks in the wilderness and kept everything intact, and they were able to return with everything. This guy didn't like that a whole lot. He didn't care about that a whole lot. Actually, if you go to verse 10, you'll see what his answer was to the servants. Somebody want to read that?
And Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master."
All right, so he refused to help David, and he questioned who David even was and who was Jesse. And David decided he was going to go kill all the men. He was on the way to kill all the men in this guy's household. It was his plan. Abigail had been told of what was going on, and she loaded up a whole bunch of supplies, and she sent him out, and then she went and talked to David himself. So David backed off of it. Actually, when she finally tells him after a night of him partying about how much money he has, and he kind of sobers up the next day. She tells him what she had sent to David. He had a heart attack. He died a week later, and David ended up marrying her. But a little detour here, because I want you to understand there are three words in the Hebrew Bible for foolish. To mean foolish. The first is kasil, which means slow or stupid. It means you don't know any better. You're just kind of a fool. Then there's another one, ewil, which means an unreasonable person. And then there's one that means brutish and stubborn. And guess what that one's named? Nabal. It's named Nabal, believe it or not. This verse uses the word Nabal. So this type of fool in this verse 1 is the same type who asked those same doubting questions. Only for the fool in this part, it's not who is David, it's who is Jesus. And who is, then the next one is who is God instead of who is Jesse. So that's what fools today even question. So who's God? Big deal. Big deal. We're in charge of our own stuff and we get to do what we want. The naval fool lacks what it says in Proverbs 9:10. If you want to drop over to there.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding.
So those are the people who willfully choose to ignore or choose to deny God. Some people just ignore him. Some people say he doesn't exist. Some people stand in defiance of him. But they're all foolish because they don't understand what they're up against. They don't even care what they're up against. They're just pretty sure they're right. There is one verse that really has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's Ecclesiastes 10:2. Does anybody have the NIV in here? Nope. Okay, I'm going to tell you what it says in the NIV. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Just thought I'd pass that on. It's not quite what it says in the King James. It talks about the left hand and the right hand. But there, it gives you the difference between the left and the right in today's world. Right there, it's spelled out in the NIV for you. Isn't that funny, though, how that worked out? You'll see that an awful lot. It's actually come from a verse in Ecclesiastes, though. It's about foolish people and doing what they want to do. But moving on. Let's go with verse 2.
This is just interesting. I forgot who Abigail was, but in Judaism, she's considered a prophetess. And in the tradition, she prophesies that humans would go from special revelation to human intelligence. And their behavior, they go from God to their own intelligence.
Hmm. Makes sense.
Which I find interesting.
Right, yeah, it makes sense. That's what they're doing.
I didn't even remember who she was.
Yeah. They're relying more and more, humans rely more and more on our own brains than on the wisdom of God. And our knowledge doesn't compare. All right, so verse 2.
The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God.
All right, so God is always on the lookout for those who are seeking him. You can't seek God and not find him. Just won't happen. God's looking for people to look for him. Let's go on to verse 3 and we'll talk about that then.
They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not one.
So there you go.
Wow.
Sadly, that is probably what it seems like when God looks down on this world, particularly America. But there's nobody left that's actually looking for him. There is none. Everybody's turned to their own wickedness. If you think about it, the majority of the world is wicked. The control of this world is Satan. So, of course, everything he touches is going to become wicked. But people are not seeking God. They're not looking for God. They're looking for maybe answers, but it's answers to their questions, like the lady at the well. They're looking for the God they have created in their own mind. They won't recognize him when he shows up. Verse 4.
Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord?
Okay, so those are two more traits of these fools that we're talking about. They take advantage of others. Others that you should never take advantage of. Should never, you know, those who don't really know any better and it's easy to take advantage of, they take advantage of those. All the time. They do not call upon the Lord. That's the other trait. They do not call upon the Lord. Why can't they call upon the Lord?
Because they don't know the Lord.
Well, because they don't believe in him. Yeah, they don't know him, but they don't even believe in him. You can't really say, I'm going to call on God that you've been saying doesn't exist. Yeah. It's a major change. And when you ignore God, it becomes a habit. It makes it harder to ever call on him. So you got to be careful. Verse 5.
There were they in great fear that God is in the generation of the righteous.
All right. So this is where Psalm 53 has a little bit different detail. one of the verses that are added to, really, Psalm 53, verse 5, if somebody wants to look at it.
There were they in great fear where no fear was, for God hath scattered the bones of him that encampeth against thee. Thou hast put them to shame, because God hath despised them.
All right, so in 53, it is considered that this is a reference to a major military victory. Their enemy was vanquished, and the dead were left in the field. Nobody buried the dead, which Jewish culture, you have to be buried by sundown. This is a shameful act if you don't bury your dead. So that's why they are put to shame. It's a shameful failure. That's kind of what they're thinking it is in Psalm 53, what they're talking about. It's about this victory. When God appears, and it was evident, we're not sure what military victory that was, though, that they're talking about. So nobody has come up with that. But every time God has intervened in a battle, it has put fear in the enemy. I mean, God just didn't, or the Israelites just didn't win because they seemed to be better soldiers. It was obvious to see there had been some divine intervention in their victory. That always scared their enemy. So when God appears, even if it's through the actions of others, it usually puts great fear in those who stand in opposition to his truth. Well, that's... Huh?
why would David repeat so much of 14
and
53? And I know it changes a little bit, but a lot of it is this.
I don't know, Mike, did you ask him?
No, I didn't.
Just checking. I have no idea why they're repeated. There's no answer for that. They are a little bit different, but they are almost verbatim. For most of the way, they are almost verbatim. Don't know why it is that way.
Would it be, even though they're separated from each other, would it be because, like we learned last week, that whenever God repeats himself, it means pay attention?
Oh, could be that. It could be the fact that it was just kind of the same prayer over again because the circumstances were starting to match again. I will tell you what the difference may be between these two, why they might have a different point of reference in their verses. And that comes up in 6. So if you look at 6.
He would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge.
All right, so you have shamed the counsel, King James says, of the poor. What is the counsel of the poor? Joe, let me ask you. If you need counsel, if you need counsel, what have you just hired? If you need counsel and you just hired somebody, who'd you just hire? A lawyer. A lawyer. What, lawyers are called counselors, right? So this could be a different type of issue. It may not have been a military victory. It could have been God's righted something a crooked judge had been doing. They could have had a crooked judge who just ruled against anybody who believed in God and favored the evil person every time.
What are you referring to right now? I mean, because we went from 14 to 53.
Yeah, well, 53 was a... probably referencing a military victory. 14 might be talking about a victory that took place in a courtroom type setting where a wicked judge has been removed. Or it could be even more basic than that. It could have just been something happened to those who have stood in judgment of the poor. There are some people who just flat out do not like the poor, and they, you know, we have to be careful of that type of judgment on people because it only takes a few bad choices for any one of us to wind up on the street, really. Seriously, I don't care how secure you think you are. There's no security in this world. What you going to say, Mike?
Well, just more of a question. My study Bible said that one of the big differences between the two is that Psalm 14 used the personal name of God.
They did change the name.
Was a more generic name in 53 to
right.
Have a wider appeal.
That's why it goes from something singular and smaller, like a courtroom battle, or an individual person, or maybe a group of people being removed, as opposed to a national victory in 53. All of that is speculation, though, because we don't know the military victory, and we don't know if there was a judge who got his own judgment came back on him or something. We don't know. It's just kind of what it looks like. We'll know that someday, though. That's good news.
This slight difference I see on the notes in the Hebrew text is 53. It's said to a very sad sound or music. And at 14, it doesn't say
what it should be.
Yeah, and so there's no, a lot of these to remember are said, like, you know how we do our singing, the hymns?
So yeah, that's what all these are. These are hymns, right.
So that 53 hymn is a sad hymn, but 14, it doesn't say
right. What
the tone of it is.
Right. I get it. I don't know either.
It's just empty. So.
Right. All right. That's a good point.
And it says God's final trial. So.
What's that?
It says God's final triumph, so I'm going to assume that's a powerful hymn.
It could be. Yeah. Well, and this is what verse 7 is. Somebody read that, and we'll talk about verse 7.
Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion, when the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice, and Israel shall be glad.
All right, so that right there is a plea for the promised Messiah to come. They know there's a Messiah coming, and that's what he's saying. Oh, that the salvation of Israel was here, is basically what he's saying. We're waiting on it. He says something kind of strange. We wouldn't word something this way. He says, bring back the captivity, which we take as bad, but in this it means to go from bad to good. You can be captive to sin, but you can also be captive to righteousness. You know, depends on where your heart is what you become captive to.
Question. So it says, Jacob will exult, Israel will rejoice.
Okay.
So what, I don't understand, what's the difference between Jacob will exult and Israel will rejoice?
Well, Jacob is the father. He is Israel. His name is Israel. But Israel, next would be, so Jacob would refer to him as a person, and Israel as a nation. So he will, when the Messiah comes, there is rejoicing. There was rejoicing in heaven. There's rejoicing in heaven every time somebody gets saved. There is some knowledge of what is going on earth, but your loved ones are not watching you. But if there's good news, it gets spread throughout heaven. So when Jesus did arrive on earth, I'm sure Jacob was happy. The problem is Israel wasn't. But Israel was looking for something different. And Israel will rejoice when Jesus does come back and set things right. Because when he comes back, he cleans everything up, and then he sets up his kingdom on David's throne for 1,000 years, and he rules from Israel. So Israel will be happy again. They will rejoice over his return. They wanted that to be the first time he came, but not understanding it was the second time he comes, he does that. First time, he just taught us all a bunch of stuff we need to know and how to get saved and pay the penalty for our sins and all that stuff. Second time he comes back as a conqueror, not as a sacrificial lamb. So, all right, anybody have anything else on these three chapters? So we're not long.